The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by Fume. Switch up to Fume and swap out the bad for the good, and it doesn't have to be tough to do it. Start the year off right with the good habit by going to tryfume.com/dark and getting the journey pack today. Fume is giving listeners of the show 10% off when they use my code DARK to help start making the good habit that much easier. Start the good habit at https://tryfume.com/dark to save 10% off the journey pack today. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. Tired of the fine print and gotchas from wireless providers? Try Mint Mobile, where the catch is that there is no catch. Just quality service at reasonable pricing. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/dark. That's mintmobile.com/dark. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/dark. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower than 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 15, Episode 4. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing 4 tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Finn McCool, Kyle Harrison, Dale Thompson, and Kisto Healy. Tonight, we'll hear stories of awful abductions, otherworldly oddities, problematic propositions, and desperate desertions. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first spine-tingling story. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail, so lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. Are we alone? It would be nice to know for sure, but because the last thing we need is to wake up and find ourselves under the leadership of Lord Quetzlu and the Galactic Squid Brigade. But chances are the workings of the alien mind are a lot more subtle, and we're more likely to be stalked or conquered by creatures more like the ones we'll hear tonight. Abduction's bad enough when it involves a lot of experimentation, but sometimes the ones doing the abducting have much different ideas in mind for those they take. Finn McCool brings us the story of a man who probably wishes he was captured by the kind of aliens who prefer to do a little probing. Without further ado, I present to you Fight Night. I won't tell you my name, nor will I describe to you my life before the abduction. I've been living off the grid since that fateful night, and I don't wish to give away any details that might reveal my true identity or current whereabouts. It's not so much my abductors that I fear. Oh, sure, I suspect they'd be angered to learn that I survived the fall, as I'm sure they wanted me to die a slow and agonizing death. Nevertheless, I'm so small and insignificant in their eyes that I doubt they would bother to pursue me, not when there are so many other easy targets for their abduction squads. No, I doubt these sadistic aliens will come after me, but I'm not so sure about the shadowy government agencies who are determined to silence survivors such as myself. They, that is, the infamous Men in Black, came to visit me in hospital after the accident, asking many probing questions which revealed they knew much more about our extraterrestrial visitors than has ever been publicly revealed. I'm sure they would have killed me had I not discharged myself and gone on the run. It's been a year since my abduction, and I barely survived as an anonymous homeless person, living out of a tent and keeping away from the cities and towns. But now I've decided to take the risk and go public with my story because I think this is the only way I can come to terms with the horrors inflicted upon me, not to mention the appalling crime I committed to stay alive. I was a respectable citizen before the incident, a man with a job, a mortgage, and good prospects. Like I said, I won't reveal too much more about my former life, but I will say that I always had a passion for the great outdoors. After working long and stressful weeks in the office, I liked nothing better than to escape to the wilderness for weekend camping trips, enjoying peace and solitude as I slept under the stars. I was a seasoned outdoorsman by this point in my life and knew how to survive deep in the woods. I'd long since rejected the primal fear of the forest at night, dismissing tales of cryptids and ancient spirits as being scary campfire tales with no substance. There are dangers out in the woods, of course. Bears, mountain lions, human stragglers with malicious intent or merely taking a misstep on the trail. But as prepared as I was, I never could have anticipated the monsters that came for me that night. The details of my abduction are something of a confused blur in my memory. I was sleeping in my tent when suddenly my senses were assaulted by a cacophony of overwhelming sights and sounds. I stumbled out of my tent, only to be temporarily blinded by an intense white light. Simultaneously, I was deafened by the blaring of a horrific siren, which forced me down to my knees as I covered my ears with my hands in a desperate attempt to drown out the awful din. I didn't understand what was happening and how my formerly tranquil camping trip had been so brutally interrupted. But my panic soon turned to terror as an invisible but unstoppable force took hold of my body and lifted me up into the air, and I saw the huge, cigar-shaped craft hovering just above the treetops, soon realizing that I was being pulled towards it. As hard as I struggled, I could not prevent the beam pulling me upwards and toward the ominous, unidentified flying object. The blaring siren increased in volume, so loud now that I thought my eardrums would explode. And then I felt myself falling out of consciousness, and as my eyes closed, The darkness took me. I awoke to pain, fear, and a bitter cold, slowly opening my eyes and pulling myself up off a hard metallic surface. My whole body ached with a dull, throbbing pain, and I soon realized I was entirely naked, my clothes removed to leave me exposed and vulnerable. I gradually adjusted my eyes to the darkness and explored my surroundings, soon realizing I was trapped inside of a small, windowless cell of cold metal. Naturally, I realized I was in a very bad situation, but I did my best to avoid blind panic, taking a deep breath before I ran my palms across the metal walls in an attempt to find my way out. I didn't find a door or exit, but I did discover a pile of clothes folded neatly on the floor. White robes made from an unusual material that felt strange to the touch. The clothing was designed for an adult male and was roughly my size. I assumed my abductors had left these robes for me. Likewise, I suspected a trick, but I was also bitterly cold, so I reluctantly put them on. I guess they were watching me, because as soon as I was dressed, a previously invisible door lit up on the wall before me, sliding open to reveal a dimly lit corridor beyond. I paused, feeling understandably apprehensive and sensing I was walking into a trap. Nevertheless, I had no other choice but to proceed, so I took a step forward and exited myself. However, no sooner had I stepped out when the cell door slammed shut behind me, making me jump. I continued to walk forward on shaking feet, my bare sole stepping on cold metal as I shivered, and my eyes scanned from side to side as I searched for threats. I saw nothing but featureless steel surfaces, but nevertheless had the unnerving feeling I was being watched. Turning a sharp corner, I came face to face with another door which apparently marked the end of the corridor. I couldn't see what lay on the far side. All was in darkness, although my nostrils did pick up the scent of what smelled like disinfectant, possibly covering up something much fouler. My sixth sense played up as I stared into the dark abyss, my instincts telling me that I should not walk through the doorway, as I believed something truly awful lay on the far side. I stood there for what seemed like an eternity, my whole body shaking as I considered my next move. But the decision was taken out of my hands. Suddenly, I felt an intense heat against my back, turning to see a wall of flame shooting up the corridor behind me, an inferno which threatened to burn me alive. I gasped, sprinting forward and leaping through the doorway. My skin was singed, and I feared the flames would consume me, but the steel barrier slammed shut behind me, trapping the wall of fire on the other side. I picked myself up from the cold floor and brushed myself off. I was safe for now, but sensed the true nightmare was yet to begin. I stood in near total darkness for a long moment before multiple floodlights lit up without warning, temporarily blinding me. When my eyes adjusted, I was confronted by an unimaginable scene. I stood in the center of what appeared to be a small amphitheater, the ground beneath me covered in a plastic-like material. The circular surface was surrounded by high walls on every side, at least 12 foot high and seemingly impossible to scale. As I scanned my surroundings, I saw another three men in the same situation as me, all dressed in white robes, their eyes bloodshot as they groggily walked out to the center, exploring our new environment fearfully as they did so. I guessed that all three had been abducted in a similar manner, waking up in cells and prompted to don these bizarre robes before being forced into this damn amphitheater. But who'd done this to us, and why? The four of us stood there in confused silence for several moments. I guess we were all asking the same questions in our own heads, but we didn't know whether we could trust each other. The tension was almost unbearable, but when we all heard a metallic whirling sound, which drew our eyes upward, I saw steel shutters above the 12-foot-high walls and watched as they slowly slid open to reveal the monsters contained behind them. When the screens were fully open, red lights illuminated the booths, which looked down upon us. But my blood chilled once I saw the creatures observing us. Monstrous giant lizards with bright red scales, burning yellow eyes, and hideous maws filled with razor-sharp teeth. "Oh my God!" I exclaimed in shock. "This couldn't be real, could it?" My fellow prisoners seemed as terrified as I was, recoiling in horror once they saw the monsters who'd taken us. And the reptilian creatures seemed to take a sadistic pleasure from our suffering, cackling cruelly and clicking their sharp claws in apparent excitement. I don't know what these monsters had in store for us, but I reckoned it was nothing good. Then I saw an object emerging from the darkness above, a small, drone-like flying machine, which silently descended toward us. I saw its built-in cameras observing us and recording our movements, and then it communicated. A robotic and inhuman voice that somehow spoke near word-perfect English. "Homo sapiens," it began. "You are prisoners of the mighty empire of the Astri. Now you will have the honor to fight and die for the entertainment of your superiors. The last man standing will win his freedom." I stood frozen in terror, my aching brain processing the terrifying implication of what he just told us. I looked into the eyes of my fellow prisoners and saw they were equally shocked and frightened. But I almost jumped out of my skin when a small gap opened in the ground and a metal rack shot up. "Fighters, choose your weapons," instructed the robot. As I approached the rack, I saw a selection of four handheld medieval weapons. A machete, a short sword, an axe, and a spear. I chose the sword, grabbing hold of it with my shaking hands, while my unfortunate companions also armed themselves. The rack disappeared shortly after, descending back into the ground which closed behind it, and the four of us glared at each other fearfully, none of us wanting to make the first move. What seems difficult to you? Taking a test you haven't studied for? Tried to go to the moon in a rocket made of popsicle sticks? Bounced a pogo stick on the nose of a great white shark and not get covered in teeth marks? Well, sure, these are all very difficult things, but some of them might actually seem more doable than certain habits in your life. But part of that problem might be less that it's not doable as much as it seems like the process is worse than the habit. Well, that's where Fume comes in to help you switch from bad habits to what they like to call the good habit. The good habit starts with the Fume itself. It's a handsome air device constructed of fine quality materials with an elegant wood and metal finish in two very distinct styles. And there are no sticky vapors or nasty aftertastes here. What you get from Fume is a wonderful collection of flavored airs with exotic flavors and scents, leaving you refreshed, like enjoying a nice herbal tea. And best of all, it's great for flipping, spinning, and tugging at whenever your fingers get just a little antsy. And the optional magnetic holder offers more great ways to keep your stresses low and focus on the goal. So yes, bouncing a pogo stick on a shark might be going a bit too far, but your journey to the good habit doesn't have to seem so hard. I recommend trying Fume today and take time to enjoy the journey. Start the year off right with the good habit by going to tryfume.com/dark and getting the journey pack today. Fume is giving listeners of this show 10% off when they use my code DARK to help make starting the good habit that much easier. Start the good habit at https://tryfume.com/dark to save 10% off the journey pack today. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. I bet this has happened to you once or twice, where you open up a bill, get sticker shock, and wonder how could it be so much. Then you go through the line items and go, hey, I don't remember that. That's most wireless providers for you. Hidden fees and overages wherever you turn. But not with Mint Mobile, and that's what I like the most. Now, I heard through the grapevine that Mint Mobile is offering new signups 3 months for just $15 a month. And my first thought is, well, what's the catch? But that's just it. The catch is, it's 3 months for $15 a month. Why stick around with your other providers? Concerned you'll have to get a new number, reprogram your address book? Not with Mint Mobile. You get to keep your phone, your number, and your contacts. And what do you get? Why, unlimited talk and text, high-speed data on the nation's largest 5G network, and the peace of mind of knowing your high-priced phone bills are a thing of the past. Well, that and less trips to the hospital due to sticker shock. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/dark. That's mintmobile.com/dark. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/dark. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on the first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. For a moment, I thought we'd all refuse to play their sick game. Surely none of us wanted to kill one another. But a second later, the flying machine spoke once again. Fighters, prepare to meet our reigning champion. I gulped, turning my head in time to see yet another steel shutter open on the amphitheater wall and a new monster charging out into the circle, roaring fiercely as it came. The creature we laid eyes upon was the closest approximation of a werewolf that I could possibly imagine. Over 6 feet in height, the wolfman had thick, dark fur covering its muscular body and sharp claws and teeth that looked like they could easily tear through flesh and bone. It roared through its snout, a terrifying din that filled the arena. Next, the beast scanned its killing field with 3 pairs of dark, predatory eyes, sizing up humans up one at a time. Meanwhile, the reptilian aliens who'd brought us here were going wild, hissing and clicking their claws in excitement as they anticipated the bloodshed to come. Instinctively, we all started to back away from the beast, raising our weapons in desperation, as it dawned on us that we'd have to fight to survive. But our enemy was quick and cunning. The man closest to the advancing beast was short and slightly built, but he showed a reckless bravery, crying out as he confronted the werewolf with a spear. His heroic efforts were futile, however, as the beast dodged his attack and sliced the man across his exposed back. The man screamed in agony as he dropped his spear and fell to the floor. He turned over just in time to see the monster leap upon him, tearing at his chest with its claws before biting deep into his throat, spilling dark blood all across the plastic surface. The crowd went wild, the lizard's yellow eyes lighting up with sadistic glee as the first innocent life was snuffed out. Our situation seemed hopeless, but I didn't want to die in this hellhole, so I cried out to my companion, shouting, "We've got to work together. It's our only chance." I received nods of agreement from my terrified fellow prisoners, and together we formed a defensive semicircle, preparing to repel the alien werewolf's attack. The creature was clearly intelligent as it paced itself before the next attack, probing our defenses and searching for weaknesses. It had no weapons other than its claws and fangs, both now dripping with the blood of our late companion. But the ferocious alien did not need any other weapons. It was a natural-born killer, fast, deadly, and utterly ruthless. Suddenly, and to our immense surprise, the beast got down on all fours, growling fiercely before it pounced through the air with its claws extended. The alien werewolf targeted the closest prisoner, a middle-aged man, disheveled but noticeably muscular. The doomed man screamed as he lashed out with his axe, but his desperate blow did cut into the werewolf's shoulder, making it howl in pain. Unfortunately, the wounding wasn't enough to stop the predator's attack, as it landed on top of the man and easily knocked him to the floor. The victim was helpless now, pinned down with his axe out of reach. The furious beast showed him no mercy as it proceeded to maul the poor man, ripping his vulnerable body to shreds until his screams were finally silenced. With its grisly task completed, the werewolf rose, leaving the mangled corpse behind as it focused on its next targets. But the creature had been wounded, with a deep cut now visible on its shoulder, and this seemed to present us with an opportunity. At that moment, I experienced a rush of adrenaline which pulsed through my veins, and I realized we had one last chance. There were only two of us left now, and we couldn't wait to be picked off one by one. We needed to go on the offensive. I looked at my trembling companion, a young man with slicked back hair, who looked like he was barely old enough to shave. I shouted my instructions across to him, hoping our alien opponent wouldn't understand our language. "Quick! You hit him from the right, I'll take the left." The kid nodded his head to confirm that he understood. I just hoped he wouldn't chicken out. But I was committed now, raising my sword as I screamed with fury and charged at the monster. The beast was injured, but certainly not defeated. It reacted on instinct, lashing out and smacking me with the back of its paw. I suffered a shooting pain through my nose and was sure it was broken, and the sheer force of the blow knocked me down to the ground. I thought I was dead meat, but the kid surprised me by carrying through with his attack, swinging his machete and cutting deep into the werewolf's muscular arm. The alien roared in agony but responded with absolute fury, slashing out with its good arm and knocking the kid over. Soon the beast was on top of him, its maw opening as it prepared to bite into the kid's throat. But I wouldn't let this happen. Fighting through my pain, I grabbed hold of my sword and jumped back up on my feet, charging toward the enemy before I buried my blade deep in its back. The creature squealed as I withdrew the sword from its flesh. It managed to turn around and face me, but before it could attack, I swung my blade, slicing the beast's throat clean open. The creature grasped at its neck as its blood sprayed in all directions, but its wound was too severe. Within seconds, the alien fell heavily to the ground, its life force fading as it rapidly bled to death. And as I looked down upon the dying creature, I swore I could see relief in its dark eyes before it closed them for the last time. My first instinct was to go to the aid of my stricken companion. Reaching down, I gave him a helping hand and pulled the kid to his feet. I was relieved to find him shaken, but not seriously injured. We'd killed the predator they unleashed upon us, but our captors weren't done with us yet. The kid and I both looked up at the true monsters, the reptilian spectators who abducted us and thrown us into these barbaric games for their mere amusement. Their hateful eyes lit up as the tapping of their raptor-like claws increased in volume, soon rising to a near crescendo. And then the aerial drone descended, hovering only a few feet above us. But instead of built-in cameras, it now yielded weapons. Two guns on either side of its frame, aimed directly at me and my young companion. "Were your instructions not clear?" it asked in its mechanical voice. "There can only be one champion. Only one of you can survive. If you refuse to obey the rules, my masters will kill you both in the most excruciating way possible." My body froze as my exhausted brain tried to process this fresh horror. I looked to my young companion and saw something terrifying transpiring as his eyes narrowed with a renewed determination. I watched carefully as the kid reached down and picked up his machete, raising the blade and pointing it menacingly in my direction. My jaw dropped as I uttered my words through trembling lips. "Please don't do this," I pleaded. The kid shook his head vigorously before replying. "I'm sorry, old hammer. You heard what they said. Only one of us can get out of here alive." I still hoped I could reason with him, even at this late stage. But then the kid unleashed a war cry before charging at me, swinging his blade as he came. I was forced to defend myself, raising my sword to parry the first blow. The kid swore as he turned on his heels and launched another attack. My opponent was quick on his feet, but his attacks were wild and increasingly desperate. I parried and dodged, still hoping I could subdue him, but in the end I had no choice. A swing of a machete almost sliced my right ear off, and I retaliated by thrusting my sword deep into the kid's chest. I saw the pain and shock in his eyes as blood poured from his mouth, and then I slowly withdrew the blade and caught the kid's limp body in my arms, watching as the life drained from the baby face. I felt an immense guilt as I laid the kid's body down on the blood-stained floor. And all around me, those vile lizards cackled and hissed, celebrating the senseless massacre they'd organized for their own sick enjoyment. I glared up at their hateful eyes and fantasized about revenge. But a moment later, the drone flew down to meet me. To my horror, I saw its guns were trained upon me. My mouth opened as I screamed in angry frustration, shouting, "You promised! You said the winner would go free!" "Yes," the robot replied in its standard emotionless tone. "A promise was made by my masters. Let us grant you your hard-won freedom." And with that, it opened fire, shooting a single dart which hit me square in the chest. I felt whatever poison the dart contained coursing through my veins. And suddenly I became very woozy, my whole world spinning as I lost my footing and collapsed heavily to the floor, and once again the darkness consumed me. I awoke to an icy cold breeze against my skin and the foul cackling of the lizard people in my ears, and a second later I was falling. I screamed as my body plummeted, and I saw the treetops rapidly coming at me. I hit the top branches hard, the pain shooting through me as I felt my ribs cracking. I must have struck a dozen branches on my way down, but the trees broke my fall and surely saved my life. Nevertheless, I hit the ground with considerable force, and both my legs snapped like twigs upon impact. I screamed once again as I rolled over on my back, looking up in time to see the massive alien ship ascending into the night sky. I'm sure my reptilian abductors meant for the fall to kill me, or at least mortally wound me, and I would surely die out in the woods had it not been for my stubborn refusal to give in. Once again, I fought through the pain and crawled along the forest floor for hundreds of yards. Every movement was agony, but I kept on going until I reached a service road leading through the forest. Even then, I probably would have died of exposure, but as luck would have it, I was found by a park ranger out in patrol and evacuated by air ambulance to the nearest hospital. It was during my lengthy recuperation that I was visited by representatives of an unidentified government agency who were very interested in hearing my story. I'd already given my statement to the local police, who no doubt thought I was insane. The reports must have been passed up the chain of command and eventually reached the ears of the people who mattered. The black-suited individuals who came to my bedside pursued a very aggressive line of questioning, and they seemed to know a lot more about the reptilian aliens, who they called the Astri. I survived on my wits thus far, and I had a very bad feeling about these guys. I reckoned it was only a matter of time before they paid me another visit, one which I didn't expect to survive, and so, as soon as I was able to walk, I discharged myself and went on the run, and I've been running ever since. I suppose I've taken a considerable risk by breaking my cover, using a computer in a public library to communicate my story to the world, but I suspect I'm not the first straggler to have been taken by these monstrous aliens, and I believe our government knows exactly what the Astri are doing to their people. But for whatever reason, they're determined to cover up the truth. I believe people need to know the harsh realities of the universe. But that's not the only reason I decided to break my silence. Three innocent men died on that fateful night, one of whom by my own hands. As you can imagine, I'm plagued by nightmares following the massacre, but I'm also racked by survivor's guilt. Those men who died so far from home, they deserve to be remembered. So please, spread the word of this insidious intergalactic threat, and make sure my companions did not die in vain.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
I hope you enjoyed Fright Night by Finn McCool, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Finn-McCool. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/FINN-MCCOOL. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. I once had to fight in a tournament to the death against a number of heavily armed opponents. That's it. That's the story. Ask no more questions. Keep watching the skies, they say. But sometimes it's not for the reasons you might be thinking. It might just be so you avoid getting hit by falling space junk. In this next story by Kyle Harrison, an investigation into a fallen satellite leads to a much less pleasant discovery. Without further ado, I present to you The Moving Mountain of Madness. There are approximately 4,550 satellites orbiting our planet on any given day. Throughout the year, almost 100 tons of space metal crashes to our Earth, often never recovered. Some have worried that this sheer amount of junk that's slowly rotating around our planet will one day be a threat due to the continuous collisions of debris with one another. This is why we often need to collect data from the crash sites to determine the cause of the collision. Often, they're equipped with data boxes that are meant to survive re-entry. True, that isn't always possible, and there are a lot of factors involved that make every crash different. This is likely what was running through my head when I was informed a research satellite had crashed over the Gobi Desert. I considered it no different from the dozens of others we'd retrieved in recent years. Unfortunately, I knew as soon as I discovered the likely location that getting there would not be easy. The Chinese and Mongolian military aren't exactly friendly when it comes to anyone coming over to their land, no matter what the reason is. And this is why we had to be discreet, and why we hired mercenaries. Guns for hire that could conjure up a story about their whereabouts if they got caught and would do anything for a quick buck with few questions asked. My task was to be their official rep from the company And when I met the group, I admit I had my doubts about their efficiency. There were 7 of them altogether, 6 from different Euro backgrounds and 1 American, all of them with rap sheets longer than I felt comfortable with. But I didn't want to seem intimidated by 4 men and 3 women when I'd been doing this for longer than some of them had been alive. So I decided to focus on the mission. The trajectory of the crash has told us that the majority of the debris fell near the Mongolian border. It's likely the data box is in that area too, somewhere near these cliffs. I paused as I debriefed them. Part of me felt angry they didn't seem to be concerned with the details, but I suppose this was still considered a routine grab and bag. We had no indication there was anything out of the ordinary. We'll be under the guise of a tour group leaving out of the Ulaanbaatar first thing in the morning toward the northern parts of the desert. The caravan will be crossing over several border patrols to the Amag Omnigovi. From there, we'll find a way to depart into the deeper central nexus of the desert. The plan's twofold. Part of the group will remain with the caravan until they reach the Chinese border and report any further information pertaining to possible secondary sites. The main group will head west. That terrain is more dangerous and arid there, not as easily explored, but it will likely yield results. Before you ask how we break free from the caravan, we'll contact a local Tibetan guide who's experienced in the camel trails. That'll be the only way our presence can remain undetected, I told them. I went on to explain what to do if, on the off chance, they were questioned by authorities, and what story to tell, but once again, it felt like they really weren't paying attention. Then, I provided them with false papers and documents to mirror the story of our vacation to the Gobi before making sure that I had my own. Despite the tension I felt, I was sure that the retrieval would be over within 48 hours, but I should have been the one to ask more questions. 7 hours later, I was boarding a corporate flight to the east, trying to remain calm and self-assured that I'd make it home. On my way, a call from our chief analyst reminded me what this was all about. I'm going to be sending you some information that relates to the last few transmissions from the satellite. See if you can match them with the data you have on your search area, he told me. I waited for the downloads and pulled the images up side by side. Are they different angles? I asked. They look like completely different areas of the desert. As I'm sure you know, we've been monitoring electromagnetic activity across Asia with those satellites for some time. I'm going to send a separate reading that provides further detail about the image you just received, the analyst told me. The second reading looked like a geological scan detailing shifts in the Earth itself. From what I was gathering, it showed a trail where something massive had moved beneath the desert's surface. I must be seeing things, I said, as I realized the signature of one of the larger rock formations appeared to have distinctly changed from the 2 images. What you're seeing is the latest imagery from the satellite taken almost 72 hours ago. We'd focused on the reading due to its unusual activity. The mountain, as you can see, appears to have moved across the desert, he told me. And then the satellite crashed, I asked. Not until we attempted to triangulate the data with some of our findings from Afghan provinces, the analyst told me. I sat back and rubbed my forehead tiredly, not fully grasping what he was saying. So the satellite was sending some kind of frequency to the mountain to scan it and then just blacked out, I asked. That's the running theory. We'll know more once the box is back in our custody, my boss told me. Sounds fun. Do we think this has anything at all to do with the Atlantic event? I asked. That's why you're there, remember, Taggart? Find out what you can and keep us in the loop. Now, head out. I felt suddenly overwhelmed with a sense of purpose that I didn't understand but wanted to learn more. I was slightly excited to learn this wouldn't be a routine retrieval, and my mind started to ponder what other secrets this expedition would reveal. Little did I realize what our search would unleash. The capital of Mongolia looked like it was being swallowed up by a wasteland on all sides. A metropolitan, dreamlike fantasy land that was separate from the harsh realities of the desert. My crew landed before I did and had booked a small hotel in the east part of town. To match our low poverty profile, the leader told me snidely, when I arrived, the rest of the caravan wasn't far off. I told them to be ready to move out despite all of the recent travel. You guys work to get paid, so the faster you get this done, the sooner we can go home, I told them. The women didn't seem too happy with the way I was treating them, claiming I was treating them as subhuman. Whatever is out there in the Gobi can wait till tomorrow. I knew she was right, but I didn't want to show weakness. Their leader made the decision for me, barking for them to wash up, change into civilian gear, and be ready to head out. When we were alone, I thanked the leader. No need. I hate the sand, she told me as she stood outside to look at the sun as it set over the skyscrapers of the Mongolian super city. Hate to break it to you, love. There's a lot of it where we're headed, I said with a half smile. She crossed her arms, surprised by my dry sense of humor. You seem a bit different than the other thugs that work for the Corp. Are you fresh meat? She asked. Military branding, it's in my blood. I just focus on the job and worry about the little details later, I told her. Army? She guessed. To generations. I plan to let go once my debts are paid to these corporate thugs, so in other words, never. I joked again. I'm sure you'd do fine out there rather than tied to a chain by bureaucrats. I'm Jacqueline, by the way, Jacqueline Parker. Andrew Taggart, but everyone calls me Tag. I told her as I covered my mouth to stifle a yawn. You sure you want to ship out now? She asked. Trying to see more of my pretty face, I countered. The woman rolled her eyes and said, my turn to wash up. Go check on the caravan. An hour later, we were rolling down the city streets toward one of the guard stations. From there, it would be off and into the wilderness. We opted to travel in the middle of the caravan to avoid detection, but it didn't make any less stressed as our counterfeit papers were checked and we moved toward the harsh exterior of Mongolia itself. A 10-hour drive awaited us before we arrived at the Gobi. Lots of time to turn around. But instead, I found myself thinking of Jacqueline. She seemed smart and had looks to make anyone's head turn. A shame we were both in debt up to our eyeballs. A different world could have meant different lives for both of us. Now, we were here together on a wild goose chase for a moving mountain. The first sign of trouble came about 7 hours later. The caravan had been constantly on the move, only pausing for bathroom breaks where passengers were told they could use water bottles to relieve themselves. Jacqueline and the other women didn't seem too happy with that solution, so instead, they were told to piss behind a large dune. When we got back on the road again, one of them, named Abigail, complained about feeling nauseous. A moment later, she was throwing up onto the sands of the dry earth. I motioned for the caravan to stop, which seemed to make the guide frustrated, and we checked to see if she was all right. Must be the heat or something, she admitted. But then about 10 minutes later, others in the group were getting sick as well. As I was examining their vomit on the ground, I noticed that all of it looked similar in color and substance. Thick and brown and foamy, as if all of us had inhaled toxic spores. The guide suggested that we could phone the nearest emergency patrol to bring us medical supplies, but I knew that would take hours and lose precious daylight. Despite how Abby and the other passengers were feeling, the majority of the caravan pressed forward. I succumbed to this wave of sickness right as we made it to the Chinese border, and immediately my mind went to radiation poisoning. Could it be that all the debris left a trail all across the region? I asked out loud as I tried my best not to vomit again. My head was spinning and I felt weak. I was terrified at the thought that we might wind up completely dehydrated out here due to this illness before we even discovered the crash site. Gregor, one of the meteorological experts tracking the satellite's patterns, admitted he wasn't sure what was causing this, but suspected some form of space debris had likely come down with the satellite. We should contact our headquarters for further equipment before we venture further, he recommended. But we were there at the border, and I saw that our camel guide, Abdul, was already prepared. We couldn't afford to waste the time. Despite the setback of our bodies, we pressed into the desert away from the caravan as the sun began to set. You have come a long way for simply something so small, Abdul commented as another teammate, Faron, showed a schematic of the satellite so we could get an idea of what we were looking for. It was made of mostly aluminum and other functional materials meant to survive the harshness of space. Ironic that often it was the re-entry to Earth that caused the most damage, I thought. And the black box is made of strong alloy, copper and titanium, to prevent damage to the contents. It'll look like a briefcase that glistens in the midday sun, Jacqueline told the others. To be honest, I realized that daylight was dwindling and our crew was exhausted from the sickness, meaning that setting up camp for the night might be necessary. I consulted Abdul to see what materials he brought, and he agreed to pitch 2 tents, one for the men, one for the women. We were settled away from the sweltering sands about an hour later as the sun began to go down. I didn't know it at the time, but that decision would be the first domino in the nightmare that was preparing to swallow us whole. We woke with a startle as a loud rush of air swept overhead and I tumbled out of my tent to see what had made the noise. The sky that had been peaceful a moment earlier was now torn apart by the streak of a long, thin cloud of fire and smoke that was careening toward the surface. The others came out of their tents, watching in astonishment as the object sped toward the ground, the sound barrier being broken as it thrust itself closer and closer to our planet. Then, at last, it struck the ground, a cloud of dust erupting everywhere and pushing the wave of particles toward us. Abdul urged all of us to hurry inside, but Gregor and another researcher were too slow, the sudden gusts knocking them down. It was impossible to see what was going on around us, but I heard the 2 scientists gasping for breath amid the storm. I was tempted to go outside the tent and save them, but Abdul held me back, and we listened as the 2 of them struggled for air. Then, at last, their gasps came to a stop, and shortly after, dead silence covered the desert again. I emerged from the tent to see that Gregor and the other scientist, a woman I never even knew the name of, were now dead. Jacqueline ordered an autopsy, and I felt a cold chill run down my spine. That object from the sky had carried a dangerous pathogen. Faron confirmed my suspicion a moment later when he checked our readings. If I'm not mistaken, we've just been eyewitness to the very crash we were supposed to be investigating. The readings are identical, he said, his voice hollow and filled with dread and confusion. I shared his sentiment. Something unnatural had just occurred. How could the satellite be crashing a second time if it had already done so? We were facing an unprecedented event, and our destination was the heart of this phenomenon. We were less than 6 miles from where it hit the Earth. We need to move now to determine what it is, Jacqueline insisted. We didn't even attempt to bury our dead because, as we got back on the camels, Abdul observed a sandstorm was beginning to stir across the Gobi. We may have an hour of visibility and then we'll have to stop. If we don't move now, we'll lose sight of it entirely, he told me. We only wasted a few short moments for Jacqueline to get her results from the bodies, which made me even more uneasy. Their blood was riddled with spores, having suddenly and violently taken hold of their body without remorse. As soon as that object had gone overhead and they inhaled whatever space toxins were aboard, it was too late for them. Perhaps what disturbed me the most were the similarities this spore had to the brown vomit we'd all experienced on the way across the desert. Another impossible scenario. There was no way we should be experiencing radiation sickness from a crash that hadn't happened yet. I kept all of these thoughts to myself, focusing instead on the journey ahead as we pushed through a dark valley. The storm grew more intense, and Abdul warned us to not stray from his trail. There were places in the desert that he claimed could swallow us whole. We somehow made the 6 miles in about an hour and a half with no daylight left. When we reached the spot where the satellite had crashed, Jacqueline told us to camp on the ridge, and we'd investigate in the morning. The small object had made quite an impact on the ground, disrupting a mile radius in all directions and burning up most of the area, turning the sand into hardened crystal as well. Farone chose to do a radiation reading before we went to bed, and I couldn't sleep until I was sure it was safe. "Curious. I'm not picking up anything at all," he told me. "That's good news, isn't it?" "I think you misunderstand, my American friend. There's no indication that the satellite is even here." "See for yourself," he explained as he pulled up the data. "Well, how can that be?" I asked. He admitted he had no clue, but was too tired to speculate any further. I barely got a chance to rest, disturbed by these new findings, when another unannounced disaster occurred. The ground shook beneath me and woke me, causing me to grab my coat and race outside. I was quick to cover my mouth in case there was another explosion from above, but this time, the danger came from the surface. Jacqueline stood alongside me, and we both watched in disbelief as the satellite seemingly pushed itself up from the ground and reverted its trajectory, cascading upwards toward the sky. At the same time, debris and sand and rock all flew past us and toward the impact site itself. The heat was blistering, and we both had to cover ourselves to avoid being swept up by the blast. It was a complete reversal of the crash itself, the site suddenly looking like an ordinary sand dune, with a satellite mysteriously disappearing back in the sky. We stood there for a long moment, frightened and perplexed by the incident, as the others went toward the ground where the satellite had once rested to get a better view. "Now, this can't be possible," Farone said. Abby told us all to look toward the sky. We were staring at the moon and watching as it faded from the horizon to reveal a sun rising in the west. "Is time going in reverse here?" Jacqueline dared to ask. Farone got out his equipment and studied the area as fast as he could. The readings were off the chart, making my heart sink as I realized we were in the heart of a nuclear cloud. Every second we wasted here would destroy our bodies. I barked the orders for the survivors to follow me, taking what little we could from camp and rushing beyond the ridge to the east. As we traveled, Farone confirmed that the readings were lessening, and by the time we reached 2 miles from the site, they were gone entirely. Just when we assumed that we were safe, however, the sky above rippled again and we saw the satellite veering toward the ground. Without hesitation, I screamed for Jacqueline to cover her mouth and hold her breath, leaping under the camel for safety. The noise shook the entire desert and the animals screamed. This time, we were much closer and the impact of the crash sent shockwaves across the dunes. As a result, our animals became startled and began to race off toward the east. Abdul barked and tried to call them back, but it was too late. They were now without any transportation, miles from any civilization, and stuck in what seemed to be a temporal vortex of some time. Somehow, despite the immense danger, Jacqueline remained calm and told us all to set up camp here. As the sun set again and time began to flow normally, she told the remaining crew we'd attempt to recenter the zone of interest in the morning. "I'm both a scientist and a mercenary, my lady, and I must disagree with this plan. We move into the radius of the crash and we'll simply be exposing ourselves to the bizarre temporal anomaly again, Faron warned. I think he's right. When we were further away, we witnessed it happening. The sickness we've experienced is evident that it's affecting the entire desert, even in a small way. We get closer and it puts us all at risk, I told her. If my theory is right, the reason we saw the mountain itself move is because of the anomaly. In some distant past, the mountain was there. We stay at this site long enough, it'll reappear, she insisted. Her fervor told me that there was more to this mountain than I had previously understood. So, even after the others agreed to this fool's errand, I stayed behind to ask her further questions. This has never been about the satellite, am I right? You've been searching for this mountain all along. Why is that? I asked her. Jacqueline, at first, didn't want to respond, but eventually let out a long sigh. We've been monitoring it for about a year now via the satellite, and we determined that it's made of the same material as what we found in space debris. It's not a mountain at all, Andrew. It's an alien spacecraft, she admitted. I sat down, pondering over the implications. When you were compiling all that data, something must have triggered the anomaly. A failsafe of some kind? The blackout from the satellite was from a signal inside the mountain, I realized. We believe so. We believe there is still active technology aboard the craft, which will push our species forward by centuries. Considering what we've observed with this temporal anomaly, it might even have an impact on our entire understanding of the universe itself, Jacqueline told me. I didn't like it one bit. There was still so much we didn't know, but I could tell she wasn't going to change her mind. Instead, I went along with it and privately spoke to our guide for a plan B. If things go wrong, I need to know that you can find us help, I told Abdul. Things have already gone wrong, my friend, but I understand. I'll watch the camp and give you 2 days. Should you not return at that time, I'll return to the city and send a message to your superiors. It'll be up to them to decide what to do next, he told me. That didn't sound very reassuring, but I knew it was the best he could do. Without much else to persuade Jacqueline not to return, we left toward the crash site. Traveling on foot took longer, but allowed Abby and Faron to get better readings of the area. Jacqueline was soon proven correct. The entire landmass of the area was constantly changing, eroding in reverse. By the time we reached the satellite, it was covered. The ground was stabilized, and we set up camp nearby to observe. Abby was first to show signs of the anomaly affecting her. Unable to stop vomiting, she began to panic. We shouldn't have come back here, she told their leader. Jacqueline didn't know what to do and gave her a sedative, relaxing her friend as we watched the scene play out in front of us. It seemed the longer we stayed near the core of the anomaly, the faster time began to revert around us. Days flew by in mere hours. Soon we were able to see the mountain was reforming. Faron kept track of everything, watching over Abby, and watched the mountain build itself back up. What do you think we'll find in there? I asked as I offered Abby the last of our supplies to try to keep her strength up. She was already clearly suffering from the spores again. Her breathing was raspy and her movements stiff. Nothing good, Tag. It was madness to come here. Maybe it was fate. Fate, I repeated. Faron's voice was cold as he revealed how the desert had forced him here. I see it in my dreams, the rising mountain of death. I've seen it for months now. I never fully understood what it meant until now. It was an omen. I was to come here and meet the end of my life. You were too. We all were. They brought us here to witness the rebirth of their evil. He was spitting nonsense, but his eyes were hazed and dull. Clearly a sign of mental health issues. I considered telling Jacqueline, but soon found she was already heading toward the mountain. Don't follow her. If you do, the madness will swallow you up, he warned. Behind him, I heard Abby making a gurgly sound, and we both realized she was choking on her own vomit. A moment later, she was dead. I didn't listen to his warnings to stay anymore. We were dying here. Either way, I needed to determine why. I grabbed my supplies and found the most likely trail she'd take. By the next passing of the western sun, I found what looked like the entrance to the tomb. It was clear Jacqueline had entered it somehow. Despite the fact that I knew I'd be trapped if I entered, I did anyway. The tomb felt older than any grave I'd ever come across, but still alive. The entire mountain was listening to me as I got deeper toward the core. Before I knew it, I was standing in a room full of carven images of gods I'd never seen before, not of this earth. Jacqueline was passed out, her wrist slit, and blood dripping near an altar in the center of the room. I rushed to her side. The blood was spilled on what looked like an orbital console of some kind. Instinctively, I touched it. The entire room lit up, and I saw holograms of star systems. Voices spoke of the journey these ancient beings had taken to our planet. But all I saw was that their journey had been one of death and destruction. The images showed they'd escaped a dying world, but had unwittingly taken the source of their pain with them. A disease that now infected us. The spores. Slowly, this virus had killed the race that once housed this place. And before they could even stop their trajectory, they crashed into our world. Tag! I heard Jacqueline gasp as she came to. I held her next to me as she struggled to breathe.
You were right. We should have turned around. This was a trap.
Why did you do this? What were you hoping to accomplish? I asked. As if to answer my questions, a noise came from the other side of the room. A shadowy figure appeared. Abdul. He was standing alongside several other men who looked exactly like himself. You came here because you were meant to come here. The message from the stars, designed to guide you here, was our doing. They all spoke in unison. I looked down at Jacqueline and panicked as I saw the spores were growing inside her mouth. I pushed myself away from her as she gasped for breath, and Abdul spoke again. Centuries ago, we came to this world, slumbered here. Your satellite woke us. It stirred us to bring you from the present to our past. The inevitable result was we have now infected your species and your future. All the actions we had taken, we had been manipulated so that this prophecy would come true, I realized. Cast your eyes toward the heavens for answers. But the true world we can bring about is right here on this planet, the aliens told me. I grabbed Jacqueline by the arm and hauled her up, hoisting her over my shoulders. They said nothing as we left, and I returned to camp. I'm not sure why it surprised me to find that Faron had slit his throat and died alongside Abby. We were alone. Even though I wasn't sure if Jacqueline could be saved, I carried her toward the edge of the radius. The paradox faded, and we were among the normal desert sands. The Abdul we had met was nowhere to be seen. It would be at least a 4-day walk to get to civilization. I was sure we'd burn up by then. Secretly, I hoped we did so, that no one would ever find our infected corpses and spread this disease across our world. The anomaly would eventually destroy itself, and the aliens would not have died in vain. Instead, I passed out, and when I awoke, Jacqueline and I were in an army hospital being treated. We received your distress signal, the nurse told me. I knew it meant that the virus had ensured we would return to the living world. Did that mean people here were already infected? Was it too late? Just like they planned? I went to look at the desert sky and where the satellite had fallen. I could see the mountain there, dark and foreboding. It told me the dangerous space virus was here, now on Earth and inside me, growing slowly, spreading as soon as it was able. I found myself laughing at the inevitability of our journey together into the sands. The mountain that had intrigued us proved to be our undoing, and now it would grow and consume and watch us die. I hope you enjoyed The Moving Mountain of Madness by Kyle Harrison, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Kyle-Harrison. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Kyle-Harrison. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And once again, I would like to give a nice big thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before I go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you happen to listen to your favorite podcast and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference, and it would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the Patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 a month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, or X, and Instagram too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep if you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groeschel. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.